This is KUT Weekend for the third weekend of December. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier. Here's what we got for you this week. Why background checks aren't enough for this former Lyft driver.
And then he said, imagine that somebody gets into your car and does this. And then he made this demonstration and he began to touch me.
Some Austin senior citizens are reviving tricycles.
You just stop and you can just sit there. You don't have to worry about falling over. This is a three-wheeler.
And how to eat and drink locally over the holidays.
It's a really nice, spicy holiday beverage.
The winter season is probably one of our most abundant.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, a friendly reminder to subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. We have there links to our iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and RSS feeds. And leave us a review in the Apple Podcasts app or iTunes Store if you haven't already. If you have any questions, email news@kut.org, or you can ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Also, just want to let you know there will be no KUT Weekend next week. I hope you have a wonderful holiday and that you'll come back and join us in the new year. So the ride-hailing apps Uber and Lyft, they might pause their operations in Austin over new rules adopted by the Austin City Council. This all has to do with penalties for drivers who do not submit to a fingerprint background check. City Councilmember Ann Kitchen is the driving force behind this. And these rules were adopted on a vote of 9-2 Thursday night. Well, actually, it was technically early Friday morning. But Lyft issued a statement saying it will operate until mandatory fingerprint requirements force it to leave. A spokesperson for Lyft says that company does not operate in cities with mandatory fingerprint background checks. Mayor Steve Adler says technically drivers are not required to undergo fingerprint background checks, but the ordinance does lay out penalties if the companies don't hit certain benchmarks and provide some incentives for getting those fingerprint background checks. Now, if Uber and Lyft leave Austin, Travis County Sheriff Greg Hamilton says it would amount to a public safety issue, and he put out a statement this week opposing the proposed rules. He cites Austin Police Department statistics that suggest a decline in drunk driving arrests coinciding with the arrival of Uber and Lyft in Austin. Before these companies arrived, it could be very difficult to get a cab downtown on a Friday or Saturday night or a busy holiday. Now, earlier in this week, we reported that Austin police have investigated 7 alleged cases of sexual assaults by drivers of Uber and Lyft. Sexual assault allegations have been made against 3 drivers of traditional cabs in the same time period. After that story aired, KUT's Kate McGee got in touch with a woman who was sexually assaulted by a Lyft driver 6 months ago, and she said she would share her story. Now, a warning, this story deals with sensitive topics and might not be suitable for all listeners.
Meet Molly.
I'm 26 and I live in Austin.
We're not using Molly's last name for privacy reasons. Molly was laid off from her job in April of this year. She was given a severance package, but
I felt like I needed a little bit of something just to do to keep myself occupied while looking for a new job.
So she signed up to drive for both transportation network companies, or TNCs, in Austin. Uber and Lyft.
The one thing that Lyft does is they have you meet with an experienced driver. And so in late May, after I'd signed up, I met with this experienced driver. I was meeting him at the Whole Foods at the Domain.
Drivers are independent contractors, not Lyft employees. The meeting started out normal. He inspected her car and said he had a few questions.
And that's where things got really inappropriate.
He told Molly about how when women drink, they can't say no.
He talked about women pleasuring themselves in his car and touching him. It was really uncomfortable.
Molly says the man told her she needed to be outgoing and friendly when driving for Uber and Lyft.
So if I find myself, you know, feeling down one day, I should pleasure myself before going out and driving. And then he said, I'm going to get inappropriate with you. And in my head, I'm thinking, you've already crossed that line. Like, what else is there? And then he said, imagine that somebody gets into your car and does this. And then he made this demonstration and he began to touch me. He rubbed my arms first, then across my chest and on my breasts. He rubbed my upper thighs. And then he stopped. And he continued talking, but I didn't really know what he was saying. It was all just kind of a blur. I wanted him to get out of my car. I just wanted to kind of explode out of my skin and be anybody but the person that this guy just touched.
Then he showed Molly how to use the Lyft mobile app. When you use these apps, passengers can rate drivers on a 1 to 5 star scale, and drivers can rate passengers.
Because I was technically giving him a ride during the mentor orientation, we had to rate each other. And he had me get out my phone and he said, "Now give me 5 stars." So I gave him the 5 stars, and that 5 stars actually keeps him on the road, keeps him driving, keeps him riding, keeps him in this position of power.
The inspection ended and Molly drove away. She didn't notice she was crying until she looked down and saw her hands were shaking on the steering wheel.
And I was just trying to imagine, how am I going to tell, you know, people that I love? How do I live with myself moving forward, knowing that I didn't get out of the car, or I didn't say something, or I didn't run away, or I didn't, you know, in all of the ways that you think you might react in that situation, why didn't I do that?
Molly reached out to an online Lyft community board asking people what she should do. Lyft saw her post and responded to her within the hour. The next day, someone from the company called her.
They had one consistent person talking to me, so I didn't have to tell the story over and over and over again.
The woman from Lyft told her they disabled the driver's account, which the company confirmed with KUT. Then Molly received a message on the same online community board. It was from her mentor driver.
It was sickening. I didn't want him to message me. You know, there's some things I think where apologies just can't heal. And he just needed to disappear, and he didn't do it. He came back, and it just felt like a violation.
In the note, the man apologized for making what he called crass and inappropriate jokes. Quote, "I had just done another session with someone who joked with me a lot, and I guess I was still in that mindset." He wrote that it was not his intention to make her feel bad, and he wanted to say he was sorry.
But he didn't mention inappropriately touching me, you know, basically assaulting me. He didn't mention that. That really bothered me as well.
A message KUT sent to the driver's account on the message board was not returned by deadline. Molly says she thought a lot about filing a police report, but when she told people what happened,
there was almost this air of, well, it could have been worse. You know, it wasn't that bad. And so even if that wasn't the intention, it still diminished, in my opinion, what happened to me. It made me feel like, well, why can't you just get over it?
Molly says she's still considering filing a police report. She's not alone in her hesitation. Sexual assault is one of the most underreported crimes. According to the National Institute of Justice, only 26% of sexual assaults between 1992 and 2000 were reported to police. UT Austin professor Noelle Bush Armendariz studies sexual assault. She says there are many reasons sexual assault survivors don't report to police.
They believe that the veracity of their story is going to be questioned. Coming through the criminal justice system, all the way through it, is very, very difficult. That often juries and judges and the general public want forensic evidence when forensic evidence is often not there.
Molly thought to herself, I got him off the Lyft platform. So she tried to not think about it anymore. Molly drove for Uber and Lyft for a month before she stopped.
I didn't like people being next to me. I didn't know.
The Austin City Council could vote today on new regulations for TNCs, including a proposal for mandatory fingerprint-based background checks for drivers. But Molly says to her, fingerprint background checks aren't enough.
Fingerprint and criminal background checks, they tell you what a person has been caught doing. They don't necessarily tell you what a person is capable or wants to do. There needs to be more screening from both organizations. Fingerprinting is the first step, but the second step is having direct contact with the people you're putting on the roads.
Molly says a fingerprint background check probably wouldn't have prevented her situation.
But I think had someone sat for 2 minutes and talked to this guy, he would not have ever been in that position.
Uber and Lyft both oppose fingerprint background checks. Lyft stands behind its current background check system, which checks municipal, county, state, and federal records. According to the company, 80% of its drivers are part-time, and the cost of fingerprinting could deter those drivers from signing up. Lyft does not operate in cities that require fingerprint background checks. Professor Noel Bush Armendariz at UT says any information is good information if it keeps a community safe. But fingerprinting Uber and Lyft drivers won't end sexual assaults.
If we really want to do something about holding perpetrators and offenders accountable, we need to think from a community-wide perspective, really, how do we tackle that problem by telling ourselves the truth about underreporting, about how we treat victims in the criminal justice system.
Kate McGee, KUT News.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is inviting world leaders to the United Nations on April 22nd, which is Earth Day, to sign the landmark agreement to tackle climate change, the one that was reached in Paris. He told reporters this week he wants leaders of nearly 200 countries that approved the deal last weekend to come to the UN headquarters on the first day it opens, because he says this will be the first ever universal climate change agreement. Now, in Texas, conservative politicians routinely rail against efforts to reduce CO2 emissions. A lot of them have vowed to dismantle the international agreement to combat climate change. But is a future that's less reliant on fossil fuels really that bad for Texas? KUT's Moz Bouchel reports.
All the political drama of Texas lawmakers attacking the EPA, denying climate science, it's usually taken for granted that at the heart of the whole thing is cold, hard cash. A lot of people think Texas stands to lose economically if the world reduces or ends its reliance on fossil fuels. Michael Weber isn't buying it.
I think that's basically false. I think Texas is actually one of the best states that's positioned to not only manage transition to a lower carbon future, but profit handsomely from it.
Weber is deputy director of the Energy Institute at UT Austin. Why does he say that? Texas has more wind and solar energy potential than many other whole countries. And Weber points out the retirement of coal plants could be a boon to the state's natural gas industry. Texas has tons of natural gas.
So the same companies that produce oil also produce gas. The same landowners that lease their land for oil and gas production can lease their land for wind and solar production.
Rather than turning the Texas economy on its head, he says a lot of the same people making money now will still be making money in a low-carbon Texas. Moz Bouchel, KUT News.
Texas lawmakers continue to investigate and debate how the federal refugee program works. That's after Governor Greg Abbott ordered state agencies to stop helping to resettle Syrian refugees in Texas, citing fears about terrorism. This week, the House Human Services Committee took its turn. KUT's Ben Philpott tells us that the committee looked at the cost of relocating refugees instead of focusing exclusively on safety concerns.
Those safety concerns have been front and center in efforts to block Syrian refugees from entering the United States. Abbott says the federal government can't guarantee none of the refugees will commit an act of violence while in the U.S., and Texas has sued the feds to stop entry based on those safety concerns. But Tuesday's legislative hearing had several moments where cost was a factor. Here's Texas Health and Human Services Commission Executive Director Chris Traylor.
When we have a wide variety of refugees that are resettled, that speak very different languages, a variety of languages, and so school districts are always going to be challenged with the ability to serve those individuals.
That steered the conversation to the Woodlands State Representative Mark Kehoe, who suggested that refugees might be enticed to come to the U.S. because of the assistance resettled refugees are given.
We give them cash assistance, employment assistance, including a bonus if they find a job within a particular time, medical screening, medical assistance, housing assistance, pregnancy assistance, over 60 years old assistance. Why would somebody want to stay in another place if they can come over here and get this?
A federal judge has denied a state request to temporarily block Syrian refugees from coming to Texas. A hearing on the state's lawsuit is scheduled for January. Ben Philpott, KUT News.
Wendy Davis is campaigning for Hillary Clinton in Iowa this week. Davis is a Democrat, of course. She's a former state senator representing the Fort Worth area. And she lost the governor's race to Greg Abbott last year. Before that, Davis had attracted national attention for a filibuster on the floor of the Texas Senate that stalled the adoption of a bill introducing new restrictions on abortion clinics and doctors. I spoke to Davis this week while she was in between Ames and Cedar Rapids, and I began by asking her what she's doing on the Clinton campaign trail.
I am speaking to a number of organizing events and canvas kickoff events over the course of the next 2 days to people in many different parts of the state.
If Clinton wins the presidency, would you hope to be appointed to her cabinet?
Of course, I would be honored to be a part of that, but it doesn't play at all into why I'm speaking up and out on her behalf.
You recently wrote an op-ed for Politico in which you expressed regret for your support of the open carry of handguns in Texas. Of course, that will be legal starting in January. That op-ed came out, and then you announced that you would be campaigning for Clinton in Iowa. Did they require that you sort of give a mea culpa on that before you campaigned for her?
No, not at all. We didn't have any conversations about that, and they were probably surprised, as many people were, that I wrote that. Politico reached out to me after I did my interview with the Texas Observer magazine, in which I expressed regret about that position. And I felt like it was an important opportunity and a widely read forum for me to express my perspectives and the things that I learned from having done it. You know, when people are running for office or they are in office, we have a unique opportunity to set the tenor and the understanding of a myriad of issues. And I think we have to hold a great deal of responsibility to the microphone or the megaphone, excuse me, that we have, and that we need to be very conscious of the influence that we're having on the way that people view these things. And I wish, as I said in that column, that I could go back and use the megaphone that I had to bring attention to the fact that we really do need to address sensible gun laws in this country.
Well, I'm putting a megaphone in front of you right now. So what do you have to say about open carry becoming legal in Texas in January?
You know, a lot will depend on what people do with that law, right? I foresee issues that may arise as a consequence of it, where law enforcement has a hard time telling the good guys from the bad, where we, the general public, have a hard time with that as well. What I perceive may occur is a continuation of what we saw with the long gun demonstration. Mothers with daughters in a supermarket who see someone brandishing a gun and who feel fearful. I want our families in Texas to feel safe when they go out in public. And I don't want them to be having to worry with questions about whether a person who's got a gun strapped to their side is someone who means them harm. And I fear that at the very least, that sense of intimidation and fear is something that people are going to face as a consequence of that law.
Senator Davis, you're out there campaigning in Iowa. You're in the spotlight. You're at political rallies. Does this make you feel like you might want to run for public office again?
I would love the privilege to run for office again. And if I have the ability one day to be a public servant again, I would love that. But if I don't, that's fine too. Because one thing that I've learned having left office is that we can continue to be a voice, whether we're on a legislative floor with a microphone in our hand, or whether we're simply talking to our neighbors and our friends and people that we meet across the country about our values and why they're worth fighting for.
Well, Wendy Davis, thank you so much for your time today. Stay warm.
Thank you very much. Take care, Nathan.
Did you have a tricycle as a kid? I did, and it was like the first step until I got older and cooler and I could ride a bike. But a new program in Austin is turning that idea on its head. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey went to investigate the tricycle's local revival.
Any good revival story starts with a hero on the brink. Meet James Maxwell, 6'4", 68 years old, longtime cigarette smoker.
Yeah, I almost gave up bike riding.
Yeah, why is that?
These are something else.
Now throw in a fearless leader.
My name is Preston Tyree, and I'm on the board of Bike Austin.
And watch as they embark on an epic journey.
The trail goes on around, and all the way out and back is like 2 miles. And so we don't quite do that. We come up here, go back, and then if somebody wants to continue riding, we come back out again as far as they want to go, and then we'll turn around. So, you know, some mornings you just get there and you say, my knees aren't working. And you turn around and go back.
Knees not working is a common complaint among this gang of trikers. We're at the Conley Guerrero Senior Activity Center in East Austin. 5 shiny adult tricycles sit outside. It's a joint venture between local nonprofits Jasalo Cycling Initiative and Bike Austin. The idea is to get seniors on bikes. For those who can no longer drive, it's a chance to be mobile again. And no matter what your age, it's healthy physical activity. But two-wheelers can be tricky if you've had knees replaced or your sense of balance thrown off with age. So we've come back to the trusty first roadster, the tricycle. Our leader, Preston Tyree, stands in front of 5 60-somethings wearing bike helmets. He's going over how a trike rides different than a bike.
When you get in trouble, just pull on the brakes, and it'll be just like your chair at home. It just stop, and you can just sit there. You don't have to worry about falling over. This is a three-wheeler. This is a trike, right? When you come up to a slope of any size, you got to take it straight on. You can't take the slope at an angle because then the bike tips.
And then, like that, they're off. And I'm hustling to keep up.
You got to run to keep up with me.
Actually, things didn't happen this quickly. First, we had to get our hero, James Maxwell, settled.
This is not my first time riding it. This is my second time riding it.
Remember, he's 6'4".
We're looking for a 13.
Tyree and his crew get the seat as high as it can go. Maxwell gives it a try.
Yeah, just about right.
Looks good.
And then, just then, finally we're off, traveling a half mile of the Boggy Creek Trail, which butts up against the senior center. Out of the 5 trikers, only one has to turn back. And our hero? Maxwell's in the middle of the pack, doing well. But like every story with a hero, his personal reckoning begins to outstrip the journey at hand.
So when are you going to give up smoking, James?
I'm thinking about it.
Run good, except he runs out of breath.
Yes. Oh, boy.
Maxwell and his crew make it the half mile to where the trail meets Rosewood Avenue. They take a break and turn around. The staff tells me they evaluate each senior's physical ability before they start training. With Maxwell, they almost didn't let him ride. But he's been improving with each trek. This day was his first taking the trek outside of the senior center parking lot. I asked Maxwell if his knees are bothering him.
No, just the legs. Yeah.
The trikes will stay at the center. So far, 28 seniors have taken one for a spin. The goal is to get them feeling comfortable enough to take the trikes to the HEB down the street. Each has a basket in the back for groceries. And here, it's important to note that our fearless leader, Tyree, runs training classes not just because these people are older than your typical tricycle riders. To prove it, I got on one.
Whoa! Not too shabby. Oh, God. It does drive differently than a bicycle.
For most everyone, when you graduate to a two-wheeler, you never look back. A three-wheeler rides differently. You don't use your body to balance, and the whole trike tends to lean to the back left wheel. I learned that the hard way when I veered off the path and into the park.
Ooh. See you guys later.
Goes to show, picking up a long-lost activity isn't always like riding a bike.
It really does. It has a mind of its own. All right, I'm gonna walk her.
Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
You might be starting to plan your holiday meal right now and maybe thinking about what kind of drinks you'll be imbibing. Well, if you want to keep it Texas or keep it Austin, I have a couple people here to help us figure out how to do that. Jessica Dupuy is a drinks columnist for Texas Monthly. Hey, Jessica.
Hi, Nathan.
And Marla Camp is the publisher of Edible Austin. Thanks for coming in, Marla.
Thanks for having me, Nathan.
Marla, I'm going to start with you. Eating locally. I know some people roll their eyes. It's satirized even on television. But if I feel like spending just a little bit extra on my food over the holiday, you're an evangelist for eating locally. Why would I want to do that?
There are so many reasons, but I'll give you just a few high points. One is nutritional value. When you eat food that's just recently been picked from the ground, especially with produce, retains its nutrient value. Meats that are raised in humane and pastured, grass-fed, and organic manner is much healthier for you. So there's the health issue. There's the local economy supporting our local growers, farmers, artisans, food producers, our local restaurants that source locally and markets. Huge economic impact, huge economic impact. I think one of the most important reasons, because I'm a foodie, another word people disparage a bit these
yes,
days.
True.
But we embrace it. It's the taste. I mean, it tastes good. It tastes fresh. That's why chefs love locally sourced ingredients. They'll tell you that there's nothing as good as fresh local produce.
And we're fortunate in Texas in that we have a much longer growing season, or we have multiple growing seasons, right?
We do. We grow all year round, which is an amazing advantage of living here in Central Texas. The winter season is probably one of our most abundant. There's such a wide range of vegetables and produce, especially, that you can get in the winter. And I'm happy to list a few things.
I was just about to ask you, what's in season? What should I be, if I want to do this, planning my holiday meal around?
Well, what goes better with the holidays than roasted vegetables, right?
Absolutely.
So roasted vegetables, we've got cauliflower, broccoli, all the brassicas. We'll be having Brussels sprouts. If they're not out now, they'll be out very soon. Potatoes, we have carrots, all the root vegetables, the beautiful beets. All of those are delicious when they're roasted, and they go very well with holiday meal planning. Then we've got squash, all kinds of winter squashes, spaghetti squash, butternut squash, patty pan squash, all kinds of delightful, beautiful, colorful squash and pumpkins. And then you've also got the abundance of greens. So you've got all your collards and your mustards and your spinach and arugula and all the lettuces all flourish at this time of year.
Meat-wise, there are a number of ranches around Austin in Central Texas.
There are multiple ranches. You can get turkeys, you can get duck, you can get pork. There's lamb, Dorper lamb, which is really a fine meat lamb. And goat meat is a very Texas tradition. And you can get local goat. It's not just the dairy goats that we raise here in Texas. We raise meat goats, and that's becoming more popular on menus and restaurants as well.
I was looking at your website and I found the list of farmers markets. I had no idea that there were so many farmers markets in the Austin area. It seems like they're open every day of the week.
Every day of the week. You can find a farmers market in Central Texas, and we have a map so you can see where they are near you or where you might be traveling. There are multiple markets. Local urban markets in Austin, like Boggy Creek Farm, and they're open 4 or 5 days a week to shop at Boggy Creek Farm. Springdale Farm has multiple days. So you really can easily find ways to connect with local food, or you can get it delivered to you or pick up as a CSA, Community Supported Agriculture program you can subscribe to.
All right. Stay right there, Marla. Time to talk about drinks. Jessica Dupuy.
Yeah.
Drinks columnist for Texas Monthly. If I want to keep Texas in my glass over the holidays, Jessica, let's start with beer. What do you recommend?
Well, obviously, there's quite a large selection of craft beers throughout the state, so it's kind of hard to narrow down the best tasting ones, right? And they change so often. But I think there's a way to go about this that's kind of fun. Carbach Brewery, which is out of the Houston area, they have done a little bit of a play on the classic Christmas Story, that movie that we've probably all seen ad nauseum every every season. They've got a beer called You'll Shoot Your Eye Out. Yule spelled Y-U-L-E as in the Yule log. And if you remember that film, it's all about
The BB gun,
the Red Ryder. That's right. So this is an homage to that special movie. But it's also a really great holiday beer. So let me just say that first of all. It's a little bit malty. It's got some elements of like ginger and cocoa nib, but also some orange peel. It's a really nice, spicy holiday beverage if you want to go the beer route. And you can find it at most of the retailers like H-E-B, Whole Foods throughout Austin.
It's pretty widely available.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But for the season only. So get it now before the movie starts playing over and over on cable.
I will need a few of those if I have to sit through that movie one more time.
Exactly. Yes.
All right. What about if I want something a little stronger like a cocktail?
I am a big fan of the classic old fashioned, and that's an old school cocktail that's made typically with either rye or bourbon, a little bit of simple syrup or some sugar, and then orange peel. There is a really cool twist that I've had recently that I have been making a lot at home. And we've got Treaty Oak Distillery here in the Hill Country that makes an antique gin. So if you think about the qualities of gin, there's this, you know, herbal note to it, but they've aged it in a barrel. And by doing that, it's kind of added some characteristics of, you know, allspice and cinnamon and things that actually really evoke the holidays.
So is it more of a brown liquor? Because it's
It looks like a bourbon, but it's made with gin. So it's just been aged. And that's because the barrel's imparted the color and everything to it. But you make an old fashioned with that, and it's definitely different, but it's something that that person who wants that boozy feeling when they're having a nice, rich cocktail, they're going to appreciate this. I think it's a nice change up from the average old fashioned.
Now, I got to ask you about wine. I know you're a level two sommelier. Can you give me sort of the idiot's guide for wine over the holidays?
Sure. It depends on what you're serving, obviously, for dinner. But the go-to wines have always been, you know, like Pinot Noir, because it's not, you know, it's not too abrasive or too hard. It's usually a nice light red wine, or Chardonnay, which everyone seems to at least appreciate to some degree. But if you're going Texas, you have to be a little more creative, because Pinot Noir is certainly not our specialty here. I would suggest wines made from a grape called Merlot, which is a French Rhone Valley grape that's very popular as a blending grape in the south of France. But it's also a great grape for Texas, and it's one that a lot of different wineries have been doing as a single variety wine. Some good examples would be William Chris. They have a Texas Merlot, which is delicious. 4.0 Cellars is selling one that's made by Brennan Vineyards for 4.0 Cellars, and it's amazing. That actually, both of those wines actually just made the Texas Monthly Top 20 Wines for 2015. So I fully support those.
Spell Merlot for me.
Okay, Merlot. It's Mourvedre.
Okay.
So it looks like Mourvedre.
Okay.
If you're going to say it, I guess, as a Texan, but and the French would say Mourvedre with a little bit of a accent on the end.
Okay.
Or some people are calling it Mourvedre, however you want to say it.
Well, now I know what to look for.
Yes.
Jessica Dupuis is a drinks columnist for Texas Monthly. You can read her list of the best Texas wines of 2015 at texasmonthly.com. And Marla Camp is the publisher of Edible Austin. You can find that magazine all over the city or read it on their website, edibleaustin.com. Jessica, Marla, thanks for your time. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Cheers.
We have started a new project at KUT we call AT Explained, like AT Explained. It's a good hashtag. Anyway, we want you to tell us what you want to know about Austin. It's people. I mean, this could be sidewalks. It could be weather. It could be music venues, whatever. Just go to KUT.org, find the AT Explained link, and type your question. KUT's Jennifer Staten spoke to KUT News editor Matt Largy to find out more.
So, you know, the first question has to be explain AT Explained.
Of course. Okay, so here's the quick explanation. The idea is to bring more people into the journalism that we're doing here, to get people outside the station more involved with the stories we do. Sometimes we'll get people emailing us or whatever, and they'll say, hey, why don't you do a story about such and such a thing? And sometimes we do those stories, and really those stories often turn out to be really great stories that we never would have found otherwise. You know, people just know things about their own neighborhood that, you know, we don't have a way of doing. So we want to do more of that, and that's kind of what AT Explained is all about. That's why we want your questions.
So what kinds of questions are we looking for here?
Okay, so the best questions, I think, are about things that don't really seem like news necessarily. Questions that are about things that last, that have a shelf life, I guess. Things that maybe you see every day and you wonder, hey, what's the deal with that? Or where'd that come from? Or why did we do things that way? Or what have you. We got a couple of questions like, how did they decide to build I-35 where they did? Great question. Where does our recycling end up? Also a great question. And I think both of those kind of add to our understanding of the city that we all live in. But really, your question could be about anything.
So somebody goes to KUT.org. It's right there on the front page, how to submit a question. So
up in the upper right-hand corner.
Yeah, it's really easy to see. So what happens, though, after somebody submits a question?
Okay, so you put your question in at KUT.org, and then at some point, probably after the first of the year, in a couple of weeks, we'll pick several of the questions that we get. We'll kind of moderate those questions and make sure that, you know, just kind of referee them a little bit. Then we'll put those up for a vote. And anyone can vote on those. And the winner of that voting round, that'll be the next question that we investigate. In some cases, we'll get the person who asked the question to come along and help our reporter report on the story. And then we'll tell everybody what we found. We'll report on it on the radio and online at KUT.org.
Any idea how many?
You know, ideally, this project doesn't have an end date. We really want to hear more and more questions. And we figure that the more questions that we answer, the more people will be spurred to ask their questions. So we really want to keep this going, forever.
All right, KUT's Matt Largie, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jennifer.
And again, you can find that spot to submit questions at KUT.org. I'm Jennifer Staton, KUT News.
That's KUT Weekend for the third weekend of December. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. Send any questions or comments to news@kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks again for listening. Happy holidays. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. ¶¶